is identity liberalism?
Identity liberalism, as I understand it, is expressive rather than persuasive. It's about recognition and self-definition. It's narcissistic. It's isolating. It looks within, and it also makes two contradictory claims on people. It says, on the one hand, you can never understand me because you are not exactly the kind of person I've defined myself to be. And on the other hand, you must recognize me and feel for me. Well, if you're so different that I'm not able to get into your head and I'm not able to experience or sympathize with what you experience, why should I care?
Who are some of the groups that liberals have appealed to in ways you find to be counterproductive?
To take one example, I mean, the whole issue of bathrooms and gender. In this particular election, when the stakes were so high, the fact that Democrats and liberals more generally lost a lot of political capital on this issue that frightened people. People were misinformed about certain things. But it was really a question of where young people would be going to the bathroom and where they would be in lockers. Is that really the issue we want to be pushing leading up to a momentous election like this one? It's that short-sightedness that comes from identity politics.
I'm just imagining some of your fellow liberals being rather angry at you saying such a thing.
Well, those are the liberals who don't want to win. Those are the liberals who are in love with noble defeats. And I'm sick and tired of noble defeats. I prefer a dirty victory to a noble defeat. The president who did the most for black Americans in 20th century history was Lyndon Johnson. And he got his hands dirty by dealing with Southern senators, Southern congressmen, horse trading with them, cajoling them, learning what not to talk about, and he got civil rights passed and great society programs. That should be the model. Get over yourself.
Do you oppose transgender rights or simply oppose talking about them in the way that people have been talking about?
No, it's a question of emphasis. The fact that, I mean, these are things to be talked about. You can't do anything without educating the public, right? And that's a slow work.
So toward the end of the campaign, we interviewed some voters in Raleigh, North Carolina, which is a generally Democratic city. And I'm thinking of a young couple. They had two kids. They described themselves as Christian. They oppose gay marriage. And they were saying that even though they didn't like Donald Trump, they were thinking of voting for him. And one of the reasons was they felt that their very views were making them socially unacceptable. They were feeling a little alienated from the world.
Oh, I've just been flooded with emails of people just giving testimonies of their lives saying exactly this. I got an email from a guy who works for some sort of defense contractor, some lower-level job, served in the military. And he said, look, I served in the military with black and Latino soldiers. My supervisor is a young black woman who's smart as a whip, and I admire her, and we get along great. I belong to a bowling team with black and Latino co-workers. And when we get together and we talk about politics, I'm almost quoting him, he said, we don't talk about Black Lives Matter. We talk about what matters to our families, we talk about jobs, and we talk about the fate of the country. That is America, and you can reach those people.
So you published an essay on this the other day. How's it gone over at Columbia University, where you are, New York City?
Well, I don't know yet. I do know that a law professor there published an article calling me a white supremacist.
Are you? Just thought I'd throw it out there.
Yes, of course. Of course I am. Of course not. And even have to answer the question is offensive, but it shows the narrow-mindedness. I was very glad to see the article because it showed exactly what I'm talking about. The only response I would have is, I rest my case.
Mark Lilla is the author of The Shipwrecked Mind on Political Reaction. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We report next on a wave of nostalgia in Poland. People miss old greasy spoon diners known as milk bars, which were subsidized under communist governments in the past. Now many have gone out of business after subsidies were cut, and Poles who long for tradition are reviving them. Joanna Kakisis reports from Warsaw.
There's a famous scene in the 1980 Polish cult film Teddy Bear that's set in a bar Mleczne, a milk bar. There's this long line of diners ordering dishes like mashed potatoes with lard. People use cutlery chained to the tables. It's supposed to symbolize a dark chapter in Poland, a time of rationing and bureaucracy. But not to Jakub Szwendowski. He was in kindergarten when communism fell in 1989. One of his earliest memories is eating Russian dumplings and potato pancakes at his hometown milk bar. Now he's 32 and lives in central Warsaw, surrounded by wine bars.
Do you go to wine bars?
No.
He eats out at one place, his local milk bar, Złota Kurka, or the Golden Hen. That's where I met him. He's been coming here every weekend for the last 7 years. I always get the same thing, he says, Russian dumplings and potato pancakes, which taste kind of like his grandma's food.
Tapas bars, wine bars, or wherever the hipsters are going these days, those are just foreign fads. Milk bars are ours. And even if there's just one left standing, I'm going to eat there.
The first milk bar opened in Warsaw in 1896, when a cow farmer decided to sell cheap, largely dairy-based meals. After World War II, during communist times, there were 40,000 milk bars, though none with cutlery chained to the tables. Public funding to milk bars was cut after democracy, said Polish culture writer Olga Drenda. She spoke by Skype.
So if they close down, it means that either the city that they rely on or the state funding has been reduced. The interest in them remains because there is always a group of people who just look for affordable food.
I had dinner at the Golden Hen with a Polish journalist named Paweł Pieniążek. We ordered dumplings, potato pancakes, and a watery fruit drink called compote, all delicious.
Mm. So this whole meal was how much?
A bit more than $4.
So $4 for basically for both of us to eat and drink.
Yeah.
That's not a deal you get in too many places, huh?
No way.
Another Warsaw milk bar, Prasova, closed in 2011 after its state subsidies were cut. Protesters occupied it, and it reopened 3 years ago with private backing. Bartolomei Jalocha runs the kitchen here. He makes his mama's meaty barley soup. He also makes burritos.
People don't come here just for the prices. It's a place to be seen. Like right there in line, there's a businessman, there's an actor, people from all walks of life.
Milk bars, he says, are fashionable now. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Warsaw.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:18 on this Friday, day after Thanksgiving. Glad you could join us. Coming up, we'll be bringing you news headlines from NPR. And then on the WPR newscast, a spokeswoman for the National Retail Federation talks about what Black Friday sales mean for mom-and-pop retailers. That story is coming up in about 2 minutes.
Support comes from the App Factory at UW Parkside. Is your business or nonprofit in need of a mobile app? Student interns at the App Factory make state-of-the-art and user-friendly apps for phones and other mobile devices. Web applications, too. For more information, visit appfactory.uwp.edu.
Run December 1st through the 11th. WPR is proud to promote live theater performance. For more information, go to wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Stores and malls from Seattle to Miami are crowded with holiday shoppers this morning looking for Black Friday deals. Retail analysts say toys, clothing, and electronics remain popular. In Chicago, shoppers are seeing protesters along Michigan Avenue's Magnificent Mile. NPR's David Shaper says they're calling for greater accountability from Chicago police.
The protests come almost 1 year to the day after the release of video showing a Chicago police officer shooting and killing 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. While there have been some reforms in the Chicago Police Department over the last year, activists want more accountability, including civilian oversight of the police here.
Authorities in Michigan may announce charges today in this week's fatal shooting of a Wayne State University police officer. The 5-year veteran was shot in the head while on patrol a few blocks from campus. Detroit police have a suspect in custody. As Spain deals with an ongoing separatist push by leaders in Catalonia, another such effort is being led by regional Basque politicians. Lauren Freyer reports from Madrid.
A Basque nationalist has been re-elected as leader of the Basque region in northern Spain. He's demanding that Spain officially recognize the Basque country as a nation. That would entail amending the Spanish constitution and allow the Basques to decide whether to stay part of Spain or form their own country. Madrid opposes any such moves.
I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A national retail group says 2 million more people are set to shop this Thanksgiving weekend. National Retail Federation spokeswoman Anna Serafin Smith says the majority of roughly 137 million people who are either considering or planning to shop are searching for Black Friday deals.
74% of shoppers are going to be shopping on Black Friday, and then followed by 47% are heading to stores on Saturday. And then of which that particular number, 24% are actually going in to support small business Saturday.
She says that's about a 2% increase in shoppers who plan to support small businesses last year. About 36% of roughly 7,200 people surveyed by the National Retail Federation are planning to take advantage of deals on Cyber Monday. One of the men who wore a costume depicting President Obama in a noose to a University of Wisconsin football game has apologized. Lee Johnson tells the Wisconsin State Journal that, quote, there was no racial intent behind the costume at the October 29th game. Some people found the display offensive. The university later revised its stadium policy to prohibit nooses and ropes and revoked season tickets for Johnson and the other fan. Johnson says he exercised poor judgment and accepts responsibility for his actions. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Encore.org, presenting Generation to Generation, a campaign aimed at mobilizing 1 million adults over 50 to help young people thrive and uniting all ages to create a better future. Learn more at generationtogeneration.org. From Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And from Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. President-elect Donald Trump's promise to bring back manufacturing jobs was attractive, even to card-carrying union members who have historically supported Democrats. It's not clear how or if Trump can deliver. And even if he does, there's been a price in recent years when manufacturing jobs are brought back to the United States. American workers accept lower salaries. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN in Nashville has more.
Tractor trailers are pulling in and out of this sprawling plant in Spring Hill, Tennessee, where General Motors now makes one of its Cadillac SUVs. This is a plant that very nearly closed in the depths of the recession, especially when GM was on the brink of bankruptcy. Now, several thousand workers here, and things are so busy, they're working around the clock, even did not take off Election Day, which is typically a holiday for this plant.
Our workforce is tired. But they're very happy with the scenario in terms of the fact that we've got a highly popular product that's selling well in the marketplace, and that's a very good place for us to be.
Mike Herron is the longtime chairman of the local United Auto Workers. His phone is buzzing nonstop, and he's a little out of breath from crisscrossing this huge complex trying to train all the new hires. The SUV they're building is already a top seller, but Herron says not just any car can be made in the U.S. profitably.
I'm saying be careful. Like, I'll give you an example. The Cadillac that we're building right now in this plant was brought back from Mexico.
But getting production back hinged on the union agreeing to reduce starting pay by nearly half. The generous pensions are replaced by 401ks, and even the deep employee discounts on new cars are harder to come by.
You can tell somebody that you're going to bring all these jobs back to America, but at the end of the day, the automotive manufacturers are going to have to make a financial return on their investment. And in order to do that, you have to figure out a way to make money in this country.
And yet, GM hasn't had too much trouble finding job seekers at its Tennessee plant.
Make sure you put your cards here, please.
Trainees wear badges that say temporary as they line up to register with the union. Susan Richardson was hired on earlier this year.
They started hiring the locals. So, you know, as soon as I heard that, I put in, and I'm actually getting my chance at it. So I'm just very, very blessed.
She says she's been interested in working for GM since the company opened its plant in 1990. John Daniel Allen sees opportunity to regroup after shutting down his family's dairy farm.
You know, I'm 40 years old and probably need some retirement and that kind of stuff. So I've decided to step out and try something new.
For recent hires like Allen, it will take nearly a decade to work their way up the pay scale to where GM employees used to start. But that negotiated deal to cut labor costs was the only way to keep factories like this one going. Just like GM's Spring Hill plant itself, the union's fitness center is back in business. Sam Madewell is pumping iron on a day off and thinking about the future under a new president.
You know, we try to be optimistic about it, but you know, I guess only time will tell.
Maybe Trump will help the domestic auto industry, but Madewell doubts that workers will see it in their paychecks.
There's a stronghold. I think it's in every organization, company. The man is winning, you know, and I don't know if Trump is for it or against it, but it seems like the man is winning. It seems like the man has won.
Trump wasn't Madewell's choice. Still, he says he's willing to give the president-elect a chance. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Spring Hill, Tennessee.
Some other news. You may not remember what you were doing a few minutes ago, but new research says your dog probably does, NPR's John Hamilton reports.
A dog's brain is filled with factual memories. People, places, where to find leftover pizza. But Claudia Fugazza thought dogs might also have what are known as episodic memories. Memories of experiences, like chasing a squirrel.
Most dog owners at least suspected that dogs can remember events and past experiences.
Fugazza herself owns a Czechoslovakian wolf dog named Velvet. But she's also a scientist who studies animal behavior at Eötvös Loránd University in Budapest. And she helped develop a training method that uses dogs' ability to imitate the actions of their owners. Fugazza thought this do-as-I-do training might provide a way to find out whether dogs really do remember events.
If you ask a dog to imitate an action that was demonstrated some time ago, then it is something like asking, do you remember what your owner did?
So Fugazza and other researchers did an experiment with 17 trained dogs and their owners. First, each dog would watch their owner perform some action they'd never seen before. In one video of the study, a dog watches his owner stride to an open umbrella on the floor and give it a whack with his hand. Then the dog is led behind a partition, where he can't see the umbrella, for a minute. When the dog returns, he lies on a mat. Fugazza says this is when an unexpected command will show whether the dog remembers what his owner did.
So we ask them to do it.
Do it.
The dog trots over to the umbrella and taps it with his paw. Fugazza says other dogs did equally well.
Despite showing some signs of surprise, the dogs could imitate the previously demonstrated actions.
Fugazza says this suggests the dogs were taking a mental trip back in time to retrieve a memory. Those memories faded pretty quickly. Even so, they're a lot like the episodic memories people use to chronicle their lives. Fugazza says the team isn't claiming dogs have full-fledged episodic memory.
Episodic memory is traditionally linked to self-awareness. And so far, there is no evidence of self-aware in dogs. And I think there is no method for testing it.
For a long time, scientists thought only people had episodic memories. But Victoria Templer of Providence College says that's changing. In the past decade or so, researchers have found evidence of something like episodic memory in a range of species.
Magpies, black-capped chickadees, monkeys, rats.
Templer says dogs presented a special challenge.
It's difficult to test dogs, right? They're so tuned into human cues, which can be a good thing. It can be an advantage, but it also can be a disadvantage and make it very difficult because we might be cueing dogs when we're totally unaware of it.
Templer says the team in Budapest did a good job avoiding that, and the results could help explain why episodic memory evolved in people. Templer says one possibility is that reliving the past helps us imagine the future.
So if I can imagine that I'm going to interact with some individual and that might be dangerous, I'm not going to want to interact with them.
a decision that could help a person survive to pass on their genes. The new research on dogs appears in the journal Current Biology. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
There's good Christmas TV.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch.
And then there's...
'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring.
What?
Merry Christmas, Ray!
Oh, no.
I'm Ari Shapiro. What makes a Christmas special? Special, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:30 on this Friday. Glad you could join us. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Still to come this hour, it's Wisconsin Life. We'll hear about the ups and downs in one person's journey to become an actor. That's Wisconsin Life in 15 minutes. And in Wisconsin news, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein's campaign says it has the money for a statewide recount of Wisconsin's presidential election. The State Elections Commission says it's preparing for a recount, and Stein promised to file the request by today's 5 p.m. deadline. Stein says many people doubt the election was on the up and up after a report that hackers wiped out thousands of electronic ballots in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. But Wisconsin officials say there's no sign that anyone hacked the limited electronic ballots, noting that 85% of all ballots are on paper. The Stein fundraising campaign exceeded its $4.5 million goal last night and has set a new fundraising total of $7 million in an effort to fund recounts in the three battleground states. As the Wisconsin gun deer season enters its final weekend, a wildlife rehab center wants hunters to donate the hearts of the deer they take. Marge Gibson is head of the Raptor Education Group near Antigo. She says her rehab center can really use deer hearts because they provide great food for the larger raptors and eagles the facility nurses from injuries. Gibson says that most hunters don't eat the deer hearts, so instead of letting them go to waste, she asks that they be given to raptors, which consider them a perfect food because the hearts are all muscle. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for WPR comes from MG&E, committed to building a community energy company for the future by working together to reduce carbon emissions and provide more renewable resources. More at energy2030together.com.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lakelawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lakelawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakelawnResort.com.
Hey skies today, light snow in northern and central Wisconsin this morning, a chance of light rain in the south, highs in the 30s to around 40, becoming partly cloudy tonight, lows around 30, but a bit warmer near Lake Michigan.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LifeLock, reminding consumers that activities like online holiday shopping and increased use of public Wi-Fi can expose personal information to identity thieves. More at LifeLock.com. From MailChimp, providing email analytics and digital tools for helping people grow their businesses on their terms. MailChimp, being yourself makes all the difference. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Somewhere on this Black Friday this morning, someone listening to this program right now is on their way to a big Black Friday sale. And if it's you, good luck. With low unemployment and a strong stock market, we might expect this holiday shopping season to go gangbusters, but economists actually expect a modest holiday shopping season for retailers. NPR's Sonari Glinton is out with the shoppers. Sonari, where are you?
Well, I'm actually at NPR West, but I have
been out with the shoppers.
Yes, I've been shopping all night long.
Now, wait a minute. You didn't say you were talking to shoppers just now. You said you've been shopping. Are you shopping?
I've been shopping and talking to shoppers.
Are you allowed to say what you bought, or are you buying gifts for people and you got to keep it on the down low?
Gifts on the down low, Steve. And I'm one of the things I'm lucky to report to you, besides the gifts that I've purchase, is that Black Friday is less important. It has jumped the shark. Mm-hmm. And it's in part because we've begun doing our shopping earlier. Black Friday Thanksgiving, and even this week, there are some deep deals. I met Gail and Axel Otero, who were out very, very late last night, and this is what drives retailers crazy. They were out shopping, enjoying the lights, but they weren't buying because they'd done it online.
You avoid the crowds, you avoid the parking, the hassle, and you get better specials online.
How long have you been coming out to see the lights and then going and shopping online when you get home?
5 years.
Oh, yeah, at least.
Shyamalan stopped by Macy's and Nordstrom Rack. He says after years of shopping on Black Friday, he doesn't get nearly as excited because he's learned what any retail analyst will tell you. Black Friday is good for retailers, but not necessarily for consumers.
Most Black Fridays, unless you're like really buying electronics, like at Target or like Best Buy or something like that, the deals really aren't like deals. They're pretty much the same stuff that you would pretty much get every year.
Is Black Friday far less important than it used to be? Well, of course it is.
That's Howard Davidowitz. He's a retail analyst. I got him on the phone before I came shopping. He says the consumer has gotten smarter. They shop for deals online. Davidowitz says, though, people will still come for the spectacle.
And lots of people will be out there crazily standing at 2 o'clock in the morning in lines and charging into the stores, which will be totally insane. But Black Friday will still be a very important day, just not what it used to be.
Over the last few years, analysts such as Davidowitz say something has changed in the minds of shoppers such as Karen Kearns.
Over the last 3 years, it probably clicked in my brain that shopping online was more convenient.
She makes me think of that old Groucho joke. It's so crowded, no one ever goes there anymore.
When my kids were small, I went to Black Friday a lot, and it's just too crazy to go.
Black Friday is definitely not as big of a deal as it was in years past for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is the growth of e-commerce and online sales.
Sucharita Molperu is chief retail strategist at ShopTalk. She says there's not just a problem with Black Friday overall, but this Black Friday in particular.
All indicators suggest that retail should be going gangbusters. It should be an awesome holiday season because unemployment is low, consumer confidence should be high, just the economy overall is doing very, very well.
But Molperu says it's not because of the election. That's the reason shoppers gave in a survey. More than a third said that they plan to pull back on shopping this year because they were worried about the results.
And in particular, the economic groups that have expressed the greatest likelihood to pull back on spending are actually some of the lower income demographics. And that is likely to also adversely impact Black Friday sales.
It's consumers who make under $50,000 who are most likely to hold back, according to Molperu. Those are the people who are looking for those deep Black Friday deals.
Wow, you realize what an effect this election has had on people's view of the future and of the present. So we know who's holding back, Sonari. Who's likely to succeed? What retailers are likely to win this Friday?
Luxury car sales are up, and I reported earlier this week about luxury SUVs. And
the people at the top of the income scale are feeling fine.
Yeah, exactly. It's essentially the tale of two countries. It's the middle that's doing poorly, and it's the people at the top that are going to do well, but they're not necessarily going to make up that group at the bottom who's said that they're going to pull back their spending because of the election and the uncertainty. So it turns out that this holiday season is going to turn into a wash, essentially, according to the retail analysts.
Let's listen to Howard Davidowitz.
Who'll do, you know, the worst middle-level stores like Sears and Penny's because the middle class is destroyed? And department stores who are anchors in malls and the malls are doing poorly. So don't look for department stores to do great. Look for people to trade down because the middle class is poorer.
And it turns out that Black Friday, the thing, you know, the crazy, nutty Black Friday deals, that's gone, at least for now.
Sonari, thanks very much.
It was a pleasure.
That's NPR Sonari Glinton.
Here's the story of a lovely lady who was bringing up three very lovely girls.
That'll be stuck in your head all day. We have the story of the actress who played the lovely lady described in the Brady Bunch theme. Florence Henderson died last night in Los Angeles at the age of 82. She was most famous for her role as an upbeat mom who was bringing up three very lovely girls and then married into a blended family. Carol Brady talked over family problems with her husband, Mike, like the time the eldest son, Greg, was saving up for a car.
Really, he's a pretty good driver.
I know, but why can't he drive your car or my car?
Well, in the long run, what difference does it make?
It's your car, my car, his car. You got to be logical with him.
I don't have to be logical. I'm a mother.
Although Florence Henderson told the Archive of American Television that she tried to be more than a mom.
I would never wear an apron. They tried to make me wear an apron. I wanted to wear sexy nightgowns so that people could actually see, because we were the first couple to sleep in the same bed on television. And, you know, I wanted to make her as human as possible.
In real life, Florence Henderson did not share Carol Brady's perky parenting techniques, as she's told Peter Sagal on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me in 2014.
I had four children, and my youngest, when we started, was like, oh gosh, two or a little less. And sometimes my kids would say to me, how come you don't scream at those kids on television like you do us?
And what did you say?
I said, because they're not my real kids, and you are, and I want you to turn out to be wonderful human beings. And they have. I have four of the most incredible children, and I have five grandchildren.
Florence Henderson was also a Broadway star and a groundbreaking comedian. She was the first woman to guest host The Tonight Show, also turned up on Dancing with the Stars. By the time she died at the age of 82, she'd performed a remarkable feat. She remained a household name, someone Americans felt they knew and liked, even though most Americans were not even born when The Brady Bunch was canceled in 1974. This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:41 on this Friday. Headlines are coming up next, and then later this hour, NPR's Susan Stamberg reports on how the Baltimore Museum of Art is hosting a conversation of sorts between two extraordinary artists, Henri Matisse and Richard Diebenkorn. The painters never met, but now their art is being displayed side by side. More on that in 10 minutes.
Next summer, WPR and Holiday Vacations, along with Morning Edition host and news reporter Maureen McCollum, are heading out west to see five national parks from Yellowstone to the Grand Canyon. Travelers will also listen to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, tour Montezuma's Castle, and visit the Museum of the Rockies. More information on the trip is available at wpr.org/travel.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. This is a big day for the nation's retailers who are advertising Black Friday discounts to try to lure holiday shoppers. Britt Beamer is chairman of America's Research Group. He says Black Friday is twofold for stores and shopping malls.
If you get a person to shop on either Thursday evening or Friday morning, there's a 70-80% chance they'll come back and shop again during the season.
Walmart, Target, and Macy's were among the retailers open last night to get a head start on the competition. Her signature role was that of Carol Brady, the mom on the 1970s TV sitcom The Brady Bunch. Florence Henderson died yesterday. Her manager says Henderson died of heart failure at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. Despite her successes on Broadway and numerous other television appearances, Henderson said in a 2008 interview she was okay being known to many solely as Mrs. Brady.
They don't know about my Broadway career, about all my musical performances, my acting on so many other things, and that's okay. Because of that little show, I receive so much affection from all over the world.
Florence Henderson was 82 years old. Stocks are higher on Wall Street this morning shortly after the open. This will be a shortened trading day with the markets closing at 1 Eastern this afternoon. Right now, the Dow is up 41 points. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Six Frank Lloyd Wright-designed homes in Milwaukee are now in their 100th year, but preservationists say some of the houses are at risk of permanent damage and in need of restoration. Chuck Kornbach reports.
The six houses on what's called the Burnham Block are the largest cluster of Wright's American system-built homes that the famous architect designed for the middle class or working families. Three of the homes have been fully or partially restored. Nicholas Vakalis consulted on one of the restorations. He says the project had challenges, like trying to go back to the house's original outside stucco.
Okay, we have removed the stucco that had been put in the 30s. In order to find the original one, but the original one anyway had to be removed because contained asbestos.
It could take more than $1 million to restore the other three Wright-designed homes on the Burnham Block. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
One of the men who wore a costume depicting President Obama in a noose to a University of Wisconsin football game has apologized. Lee Johnson tells the Wisconsin State Journal that, quote, there was no racial intent behind the costume at the October 29th game. Some people found the display offensive. The university later revised its stadium policy to prohibit nooses and ropes and revoked tickets for Johnson and the other fan. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from American Express, offering charging credit cards to help business owners cover the big purchases they need to make when they need to make them. More about American Express business cards and services can be found at open.com. From American Jewish World Service, working for 30 years to end poverty and advance human rights worldwide. Learn more at ajws.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:45, and now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik on the ups and downs of a person's journey in becoming an actor.
Oren Reilly always wanted to be an actor. He found a way to live his dream as part of Encore Studios, a theater company for people with disabilities. Riley spoke to me using one of his favorite voices on his communication device.
I began acting when I was 18 years old, when I was still in high school. Although I don't remember the play, but I do remember I loved it.
When I first met you, which is now 16 years ago, I believe you mentioned that you always wanted to be an actor.
That's Kelsey Shaneauer, the founder and executive and artistic director of Encore Studios in Madison. Encore is the only professional theater company for people with disabilities in Wisconsin.
I've always loved movies, and I wanted to tell stories. Acting was the best way I could think of.
So that's always been a big part of your life and always a big desire. And so when you came to us, you know, we were thrilled to welcome you. And there's a lot of just great innate ability and a really amazing presence. I think your first role, the first full-scale production that you were in, you made the front page of the Wisconsin State Journal. So I know I didn't in the first thing I've done. When was that? That was 2001. That was To Love or Not to Love.
Corin is a Madison native. He joined Encore 16 years ago.
My favorite part of acting is to be able to perform for people I care about.
He's since acted in more than 40 productions in all kinds of roles.
We do 3 plays locally, and those plays are all original full-scale productions.
My favorite role was playing the character Colin in the play Real Life. I was lucky enough to be able to perform with my friend John Meister.
Real Life was something that I did write for, kind of for myself and for the other actors, and it is focusing on high-functioning autism, and it gives a very interesting, varied perspective on that really important issue that's becoming much more in the forefront these days.
How does he get in the head of his characters?
Rehearse, 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 and then rehearse some more.
There's still a number of roles on his bucket list.
Romantic scenes are my favorite. However, I don't get to play them very often. I would love to play the role of the wolf in Stephen Sondheim's musical, Into the Woods. I like playing mean characters. It's a lot of fun.
Corin Reilly is an actor in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Good morning. Thanks for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. The music starts in about 15 minutes. And today you can hear a Handel Harp Concerto in B-flat major, a piece from Jean Sibelius, and some Tchaikovsky. Hope you can stay with us for Morning Classics here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, encouraging your awareness of the Kenosha Symphony's holiday concert at Reuther High School on Saturday, December 10th. Enjoy several fantasias on carols and the Kenosha Chamber Choir. More information at kenoshasymphony.org.
Says run December 1st through the 11th. WPR is proud to promote live theater performance. For more information, go to wpr.org/events.
Cloudy skies today, light snow in northern and central Wisconsin this morning. A chance of light rain elsewhere in the state. Highs in the 30s to around 40. Tonight becoming partly cloudy, lows around 30 and a bit warmer near Lake Michigan. Looking ahead to the weekend, on Saturday, partly cloudy, highs in the lower to mid 40s. Then on Sunday, rain likely by the evening, highs in the lower to mid 40s.
Support for WPR comes from WPS Health Insurance and its Medicare Companion Supplement Plan, offering local, personalized guidance on Medicare options and the freedom to choose a doctor with no restrictive provider network. WPS2017.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, YMCA Camp McLean's Crafts in the Wood Show will be held on November 26th from 9 to 4 p.m. on the campgrounds in Burlington. Admission ranges from $1 to $4. All proceeds benefit the Summer Camp Scholarship Program.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. A conversation between two major artists, Henri Matisse of France and Richard Diebenkorn of America, is taking place on the walls of the Baltimore Museum of Art. Now, these artists never met, but Matisse influenced Diebenkorn's work across decades and across continents. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg saw the evidence of that influence on the painters and their descendants.
The museum invited Matisse's great-granddaughter and Diebenkorn's daughter to see the exhibition before it opened to the public.
Hello.
Hi.
Happy. How nice to meet you.
It's such a pleasure to meet you. Yeah.
Gretchen Diebenkorn Grant, age 71, has a lovely smile. Sophie Matisse, age 51, chic and fit, was born in Boston. She is a painter.
Have you seen the show yet?
No.
I'm salivating.
Yes.
I guess, as we could say. Yeah.
Right, right.
My whole life, we all looked at Matisse all the time. Oh, really?
And,
yeah.
And to see them
That's
together.
Funny.
Me too, says Sophie.
Yes, I'll bet.
Curator Katie Rothkopf began thinking about getting Matisse and Diebenkorn, the painters, not the descendants, together some 15 years ago. She was poking through the Baltimore Museum's storage room when inspiration struck.
We had the spectacularly beautiful Diebenkorn drawing of a woman seated in a chair and realized it had incredible resonance with a Matisse drawing we also had of a reclining model with a flowered robe. They were made 40 years apart and were done by men living in different places with different lifestyles, but yet here they were, really needing to have a conversation.
She says Diebenkorn was in his 20s when he discovered Matisse. He got hooked.
He really sought out every opportunity to see as many paintings in exhibitions, in permanent collection installations, in a few lucky cases in private collections, and it was something that he was interested in throughout his entire career.
Wherever he was, Portland, Oregon, where he was born, San Francisco, Santa Monica, Diebenkorn collected books on Matisse, stuffed sketchbooks with clippings, postcard reproductions, notes. He loved the master's women, his adventures with abstraction, his shifting style depending on where he lived, and, of course, Matisse's joyful colors. Diebenkorn's colors shimmer, delicate veils of blues and greens and grays. Teaching in Urbana, Illinois in 1952, He said he saw nothing but haystacks. He was starved for colors.
So we decided to black out the windows of a studio and made these beautiful abstractions really from his imagination.
Gretchen Diebenkorn says there was one year, though, when her father capped his color tubes. She points to a black, white, and gray painting of a dining table set with dishes.
My mother always used Indian bedspreads for tablecloths, and that is a lamb chop bone on the plate there. And my father's favorite dinner was lamb chops.
With spinach and baked potatoes. Diebenkorn made the piece in 1964.
This is the year that my grandfather died, and in that year, he did only black and white drawings.
So that was his mourning period,
yes,
essentially.
I think so.
It's only black and white. But they're not somber at all.
No, they're not depressing. They're not mournful, really. They're just, this is where he was, I guess.
The black and white works are in various museum collections. When Gretchen spots one, she doesn't have to look at the date. She knows it was made in 1964. Sophie Matisse has no stories about her great-grandfather, Henri. Sophie was born 11 years after he died, and her grandfather, Pierre, Henri's youngest child, kept pretty mum.
Well, just to be perfectly honest, he didn't really talk a lot about his father and didn't even answer questions so much about his father. I never forget one time my brother, who was nobly trying to make conversation at the dinner table, because we were kind of coached, you know, well, ask him about a story about his dad or whatever, just try to make conversation. So my brother said, tell us some great stories about your dad and what it was like. And Pierre never moved a muscle. He was just there at the table, stiff as a statue, and just suggested that he go read a book about it. So I closed us down, and we didn't really talk about family stories after that.
It's not that the relationship was thorny.
I think that he had been asked too many times.
Sure.
You know? I think the relationship was solid, actually, and very good, and very deep, and very intimate and private. He wasn't a big sharer of feelings or even conversations. What happened between them more or less stayed between them.
Gretchen Diebenkorn has lots of stories about her beloved father. Like Henri Matisse, he had a real work ethic, a dedication to craft. Diebenkorn painted every day, was not to be interrupted.
Oh yeah, never went to the studio except invited, occasionally in emergency. I only remember knocking on the studio door once. That was his space.
He worked all day. The family wouldn't see him again until dinner time.
My mother was a wonderful cook, so.
Descendants of famous men, a daughter with loving memories of her father, a great-grandchild with a distant but looming connection to a fellow artist.
Has your name ever become a burden to you?
Yes, it has, but at the same time, it's been obviously a tremendous honor.
I was happy that my name changed to Grant.
Mrs. Gretchen Diebenkorn Grant, one-time actress and singer.
First of all, it was always the longest name on a program when I was acting or singing, which was always difficult. I got tired of being reviewed, parens, the daughter of the artist. You don't want to be an adjunct somehow.
The two women move happily through the artworks of their ancestors, gathered at the Baltimore Museum of Art. Matisse's voluptuous harem women near a luscious Diebenkorn abstract landscape. Matisse's still life with blue tablecloth near a Diebenkorn still life swirled with Matisse blues and curves. It is a knockout show.
You know, I was thinking, it's too bad that the two never met, but they really did, didn't they?
They did it, and I sort of think that this exhibition will give them the opportunity to have a conversation on our walls for the next 3 months.
After Baltimore, the show goes to San Francisco. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
You hear Susan on Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme song was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. Later today on All Things Considered, we're going to take a closer look at Vice President-elect Mike Pence's efforts to win over members of Congress on passing President-elect Trump's legislative agenda. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm Norman Gilliland in for Stephanie Elkins on this Friday, 25th of November. We'll be having a musical train ride during the first hour of music between now and 10 o'clock, and that after the latest news here on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from Port Washington Tourism, nestled on the shores of Lake Michigan, with gourmet dining, boutique shopping, and more. The historical 1860 lighthouse is open for tours this summer. Visit portwashington.com.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Doug's Prairie Kitchen. Make a weeknight dinner that everyone will love using handcrafted marinara sauces from Doug's. Sauces are available in several varieties, including sweet pepper and garlic. The market's new winter hours are 10 to 2. You're listening to WGTD.